Hello and welcome back. Today we're going to discuss the really important topic of measuring patient safety. No doubt, whatever you do in health information technology, you will be producing reports about performance, either how people are doing, how your computer systems are doing. And what we want to do is make sure those reports are accurate and as useful as possible. So the objectives for this session are to help explain what are the attributes of an effective reporting system. Second, to help examine the importance of having standardized and structured health information so that you can use those data to make valid reports. And lastly, is to discuss how HIT can facilitate data collection and reporting for improving quality of care and patient safety. Now, before we get into this, I want to do a little exercise with you. I want you to score the following attributes on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being really above average and 1 being below average and 3 being right about in the middle. And this is relative to your peers. I do this exercise commonly with physicians and nurses. How smart am I? How hard do I work? How kind am I? How tall am I? And how good is the quality of care that you provide at your organization? Now, I then ask the audience commonly, like I'll ask you to see for any of the first three, smart, kind, or hardworking, how many of you scored a 1 or a 2? I have yet to see a single hand go up. I then say, tall, how many of you scored a 1 or a 2 for tall? And I get, as I'd expect, a Bell distribution, because in a group that's over about 30 people, we should see the same numbers of 1s and 2s as we do 4s and 5s. But we don't for the first three. And the reason is because being smart, kind, and hardworking are really socially desirable traits. We all want to be perceived that way. But in the absence of a valid and transparent measurement system, we're overconfident. We delude ourselves that we're all equally smart, hardworking, when the reality is we're not. Now, being tall is just as socially desirable. There's quite good evidence that you're promoted more, you're paid more, you're more likely to win a presidential election the taller that you are. But yet, you answered honestly. There was a Bell distribution. And why is that? The reason is because we have a transparent and a valid measurement system that we all use. Now, when I ask clinicians about how good is the quality of care they provide, they respond just like being smart, kind, and hardworking. There's never any ones or twos. They're never below average. And it's not because of malintent. It's because nobody went into healthcare to hurt people. We went in to help them. But that desire causes enormous bias when we're trying to measure performance. So we are overconfident. We delude ourselves, and we all think that care is better than it is, and we need valid measurement systems. Now, many of the measurement systems that we have out there aren't very valid. Here's some data of wrong site surgeries, or I should say reports of wrong site surgeries over time. And despite substantial efforts to reduce wrong site surgery, you can see all those efforts listed in the black box. The rates of wrong site surgery, or the reports, I should say, keep going up and up and up. And some of the statisticians in the room may conclude that our efforts are very effective at increasing wrong site surgeries. I don't think that's the case, but I do think it's the case that we don't have a good valid measurement system to evaluate them. We don't have routine surveillance, and so what these data represent are almost certainly reporting bias. We raised awareness, we made people more aware of what's going on, and therefore we report more events. And these shouldn't be interpreted as monitoring performance, but unfortunately, they often are, and they're what most measures of quality are. They're reports without really good definitions of numerators and denominators or surveillance, and they're not valid for measuring progress. Now, let's think of a conceptual model for measuring safety or quality, and I find this quite helpful. There's a model from Don Abedian, one of the fathers of quality. He was a physician at Michigan who came up with this model of structure, that is how we organize work, results in the processes, that is what we do for work, and those influence the outcome, the results that we get. So there's this model of how we organize, structure, are we doing the things we're supposed to, process, and then the results that it produces, the outcomes. And embedded in all of that is this concept of context or culture, that how is the way we react with each other? How is the policies? How does the way we staff our environment influence each of those areas? So let's give you some examples. A structural measure, and we'll talk about smoking cessation, might be, do you have a smoking cessation program at your workplace? A process measure might be the percent of patients who receive some smoking cessation education, or another process measure could be some percent of time spent with patients educating them. Right? Those are measures of things that we do. An outcome measure might be the percent of patients who actually quit smoking, or percent who actually do smoke in your environment. Hopefully you can see they're all getting different attributes of the same concept. That is, how well are we doing with smoking cessation? Now, for a measure to be valid, what do we need? Well, to have something measured as a rate, which is normally what we use to monitor progress, you really need three key things. You need a clear definition of the numerator of that rate. That is, what's the event? I fell. I had a decubitus ulcer. I had a medication error. You also need a clear definition of the denominator. That is, who's at risk for those events? What's the pool of patients from which those numerators could be drawn? So it could be all hospitalized patients. It could be patients receiving a certain medication. It could be patients with a certain degree of dementia. But it needs to be clearly specified. And then finally, you need a surveillance system to pick up both events and those at risk for events. Many of what we put forth in healthcare as rates are really not valid as rates. For example, hospitals often report medication errors, but those errors are self-reported, and we know they're grossly underreported. We probably report somewhere between 5 and 10% of all events that happen. So changes in rates might simply be you're reporting more, what we call signal detection bias, rather than you're actually changing safety or quality. And as we try to report valid measures, we want to minimize two types of errors. And one error is random error. That's simply error because of the law of chances. We have small sample sizes. We don't have a big population. And just by chance, we might get a fluke in what the data look like. The way you reduce random error is take a bigger sample. We also, though, have to contend with systematic error. That is, error in by the way we either sample or collect data that makes it inaccurate. For example, if we don't have standardized terms for what a numerator and a denominator are, we may get systematic error simply because of the way we collected the data. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time on what some potential biases are in measuring safety and quality. And this isn't to be a course in epidemiology, but it is intended to make sure that you're aware of what some of these biases are and that you develop strategies to minimize them. So the first bias is what we might call selection bias. That is, if you're looking at patients who had a particular complication, so let's say a complication of who had a lung injury after placing a catheter in their neck. It's a known complication of a catheter. I would likely probably sample only those patients who had a catheter, right? If I included every patient and your hospital has a fewer number of attempts to put catheters than mine do, we may vary in performance simply because I selected patients who weren't even at risk for this complication. And so thinking about who's in the sample that you're measuring is key. Another and enormous source of bias is what we call measurement bias. That is, how are we defining the numerator, the denominator? How are we picking them up? And importantly, how are we dealing with missing data? Let me give you an example. I did a little quick study where we were trying to reduce patients who didn't tolerate tube feeds, that it's feedings that we give through a tube, often in the stomach or in the intestines. And we were defining that, or letting the nurses define it, by whoever didn't tolerate tube feeds was the error or was the defect. And I asked the nurses how they define who didn't tolerate tube feeds. And there were 8 nurses sitting around, and I got 8 different answers. Now, it's not that anyone is right or wrong, but it's certainly going to put error and bias in the measurement if everyone is defining this complication in a different way. So without standardizing that to say, okay, we're all going to define it as this, we're likely going to get really, really noisy measures. So in all of these things that we're doing, make sure that there's a clear definition of who is at, what the event is, whether it's a fall or a decubitus ulcer, who's at risk for that event, and how you're going to find them. And likewise, you ought to make sure that you reduce missing data. And it's much easier to correct missing data as you're actually collecting data than at the back end when you're going to produce a report, because sometimes you can't fill in the rest of the data. Now, what are some of the sources of variation in trying to collect these measures? And let me give you a little example that we often do. And I'll make the metaphor of signal-to-noise ratio, that concept that's often used in railroading, where there's a signal, beep, 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 and we're trying to tease that out from the background noise. The background noise is wind and trains going on, and how do I really sense that I'm going to hear that true signal? And in measuring safety, there's a lot of sources of noise or variation. There's the true variation. Did what you do really improve safety or quality? That we'll call that our beep, beep. There's also variation noise that's introduced by having lack of clear data quality, lack of clear definitions, variation in how we collect the data, so you have multiple data sources. There's variation in what we would call case mix, that is patients actually risk for these outcomes, how sick they are over time. There's variation due to historical trends in performance. That is, very rarely is performance static. Often it's going up or down over time, not just in your organization, but through the whole industry. And how do we account for that? And then there's chance or random error. What you need to do as you're thinking about a measurement system is dampen down or minimize all these other sources of noise, this variation that's unwanted, so that you could sense that true signal variation in safety. Let's go through an example of what this might look like. I presented to you some of the major studies that looked at medication errors. Now, you may think medication error is the same around the world. We all describe it the same. But what you can see here in these very high-profile studies, they all varied on how they defined the numerator, on what an error was. They varied widely in what the denominator was. So some denominators, the measure was patients, some was prescription, some it was the actual order, some it was the review of medical records during the whole admission. Likewise, how they surveyed for these errors, some had physicians review the charts, some had nurses, some had a pharmacist listen on rounds, some got reports from the nurses, and not surprisingly, the rates of errors among these studies vary widely, from 3.7 per 100 admissions to 3.13 per 1,000 orders to 19 per 1,000 ICU days. And what's the right way to measure these? Well, there is no right way. What we need to do is get a measure that's meaningful for the people who you're going to give the data back to. You know, and that's a critical, important concept. I spent many years getting my PhD in clinical investigation and spent far too much time learning various approaches of how to measure validity and reliability and with fancy statistics. And I've come to realize, though they're important, what's much more important is that the people who use the data actually believe that it's measuring something important. Because if they don't believe it's measuring in something important, they'll never use it to improve performance. So a simple discussion with who you're ever giving these reports to ask them, do they really believe it's valid? How could they, will you make it more meaningful and useful for them, will go a long way. You know, let me just give you an example of a word of caution about importance of data. We did a study trying to improve care of sepsis patients. Those are patients with bad infections who are quite sick. And our initial look at the data showed that what we did across 19 hospitals or 19 intensive care units reduced mortality by about 69%. I mean, it was remarkable. Mortality went from about 42% to 13%. I mean, unheard of performance in mortality. We presented these at a meeting, and they quickly went viral on the web and were up all over the place on the webs, despite us cautioning to say, well, the data weren't really clean. And lo and behold, what did we find? Well, when we cleaned the data, when we accounted for missing data, when we accounted for selection bias, what we found was that there was no change in mortality. It was a myth that I wanted to believe in because I went into healthcare to hurt people. The project was designed to help, but in reality, it didn't work. And this was perhaps one of the most humbling messages for me about, hey, if we're going to do this stuff, we're going to make inferences about care is better or worse, we better make sure those inferences are truthful, and that only happens with valid data. Now, I talked some about measuring care as rates, and I want to make sure that you know it is completely okay to have non-rate-based measures. That is, it's okay to just have self-reports of things that went wrong. It's okay to have measures where I just go talk to staff and say, what's your gut? What do you think is at risk here? How can we improve things? There's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is we interpret a non-rate measure as a rate. That is, getting self-report of events, we do all the time. I look at our errors all the time. What I don't do, though, is then plot those as trends over time and assume that I can make some inferences about whether care is getting better or worse. So use non-rate-based measures all the time. Just don't assume that they are should be interpreted as a rate. Well, we talked a lot about the problems with data. I want to spend some time discussing with you how you can make your data more valid and reliable. Some useful tips here. The first is to structure data entry or data collection forms whenever possible. And what I mean by that is make sure those who are entering data are crystal clear about who, what, where, when, and how. That is, if you're calling something an infection, make sure those who are labeling it know what the definitions are, when they're supposed to enter the data, how they actually enter the data into their HIT, so that we get much more valid data. I can't tell you the number of times where we launched data collection efforts, and for the researchers or the informatics folks, it was very clear we're defining a decubitus ulcer as this. But no one had trained the staff who are actually the one entering the data, on what those standardized terms are. And when you talk to them and ask them how they're interpreting it, we found wide variation. Next point is pilot test whenever you could. And really pilot test every phase of the process, from writing the definitions to having the staff enter the data to producing the reports. You invariably will pick up mistakes or things that aren't clear when you pilot test. And I wouldn't think of producing a quality report if I didn't have quite extensive pilot test. I would also make sure that you formally train and you evaluate the competency of those entering the data. So I wouldn't just assume, okay, we're going to collect data on decubitus ulcers or falls, and everyone knows that it is. I would have a formal training session about the terms. I would have them enter some mock cases, and I would evaluate their performance and give them feedback about that. Next, I would make sure that you actually look at the data and evaluate data quality. Now, this isn't a research-funded study, so we're unlikely to have the bells and whistles or the data checks that more formal studies do. For example, in research study, we commonly do duplicate data entry. Two people independently enter data. I doubt you're going to have resources for that. But what we found is that three simple data checks will pick up over 95% of the data problems, truly 95%. What are they? Well, they are the following. First, look for missing data. If you have missing data, try to go back and find those data points. In many of these quality reports, missing data exceeds available data. That is, missing data may be 60 or 90% of all your available data. And as you probably know, I can't make any inferences or conclusions about whether care is getting better or worse with that much missing data. Second, look at your outliers. In all of these reports, there'll be some values that are just so outrageous they don't make sense. Things that are maybe 3 and 5 standard deviations from the norm, or that vary so much from prior data that they just don't make sense, where a hospital may have had 1 or 2 infections a quarter, and then they enter 10,000. And it's almost certainly an error, but that number could really weigh your results if you don't evaluate it, make sure it's accurate, and fix it. And the last common error or common data quality check is looking for repeat values, especially for denominators, month after month after month. So let me give you an example. When we were looking at rates of bloodstream infections, the numerator is obviously those who have an infections. The denominator is catheter days. And we saw some hospitals that would have over 2 years with every month the same number of catheter days. And that is highly, highly unlikely. What is likely is they just cut and pasted it month after month after month, and it introduces error. So look at those three data checks: missing data, outliers, and repeat values over time to try to really shore up what your data quality. And then finally, and as I mentioned this earlier, ask the consumer of the data if they believe it is valid and useful. I can't tell you how important that is, and in how many organizations managers produce reports that the frontline people don't believe are valid or useful, and they don't use it, yet we spend resources on it. And I'll give you a perfect example. When I was started working in this, my hospital used to produce reports of people readmitted to the ICU after discharge within a month. And none of the doctors or nurses thought that that measure was at all useful, because over 30 days, most of these patients were developing new problems. It didn't have anything to do with the decision to send them out of the ICU, which is what the intent of the measure was. It was they got sick, they developed a new problem, and nobody used the data. So we talked with the informatics people and the managers and said, why don't you measure it, who gets readmitted within 48 hours or within 72 hours? That would be a time period that most of those readmissions reflect a decision that was wrong to send them out, or more likely to represent a wrong decision than it does at a month. And we'll use the data. We'll look at it. We'll try to find out what's wrong. And so we changed the way that we reported. Now let's go into, assume that you now have valid measures. How do you produce a report of quality? What does that look like? Well, as I said, most importantly, have discussions with those who are going to use it to get something valid. But in general, what we present is data over time, often in what's called an annotated run chart. And what that simply means is that your x-axis of a graph, the bottom of it, is some time period, and your y-axis is generally performance on some measure. So that the time periods could be months, it could be a day, it could be a quarter, it could be a year. You generally select your time period so there's about 25 observations, or at least 25 observations in each bucket. If you get fewer, the random error goes up quite dramatically. So we could look at, if you have a lot of patients, per day what's going on, per week how are we performing, per quarter. We generally report these infections per quarter because there's just not a lot of them. We often don't even have 25 per quarter. But we can often report use of process measures, that is use of best practices, either every day or a week, because all patients get those. We have a lot bigger sample. And you'll need to discuss with your users of the data What's the best way to aggregate time periods? And I mentioned it's often useful to annotate this run chart. What I mean by that is literally put notes on them about what was going on or what you did. So if there's a change in performance, literally write on the graph, we implemented a change in our reporting, or we did this intervention to make performance, or we understand it got worse because we just started measuring a different way. Because the graph should tell the story. Someone should be able to pick up this annotated run chart and have a good feeling of what's going on for performance, what's changing, and what's not. And you will have a big role in changing that. So here's an example of an annotated run chart at our hospital to reduce bloodstream infections. It was published in Critical Care Medicine. You can see the y-axis is our rate of catheter infections per 1,000 catheter days. That's the way we report these infections. So the numerator is infections. The denominator is 1,000 catheter days. The time period is quarters because we don't have enough infections to remeasure it less frequently. And we've annotated on there all the different things that we've done, including using my checklist and empowering nurses, that shows how these collective interventions over time led to improved performance. Now, we covered a lot of material in this section. What I hope you can see is that these principles are the exact same principles that we outlined in the science of safety and in our human factors engineering courses. That is, making sure you have valid data by standardizing, by looking at your data, and by talking to the users of it to make sure that they find the data meaningful, that they find it informative, and most importantly, that you work together to use these data to save lives, to reduce harm to our patients. I thank you and have a great afternoon.